I don't know where to start and what to talk about, so I'll start with something, and if you have questions or issues that you would like to expand, I'll be glad to take it. So let's start with this. It's not, most of it is not my innovations and my understandings. It's really a collection, but it's organized in a way that it is clear to everyone who reads it what the majority ruling is on each and every aspect of medicine and Jewish law, including some ethical dilemmas that come up with it, some legal issues that come up with it, and everything is referenced, so that if you don't believe me that this is what is said, you can go to the source and see it for yourself. So it's organized in a way that it starts from before we become humans till until we die, throughout the life cycle of every person. So if we start from before we are born, so it deals with egg donation, with sperm donation, with surrogacy, with pregnancy, a lot of issues that come up until someone is born, including the status of the fetus before he is yet a full human being. All these have many, many halachic questions on how to do it and what to do with in the different stages, what are the consequences of it. So that is the part that starts before one is born. Then it goes through giving birth, regular births, is there a section, complications, what is the status of the child born, and so on, through the first days of life, and whether it's circumcision and pidyon haben, and redeeming, pidyon haben is?
Redeeming from firstborn.
Redeeming the firstborn, and going through the different stages of infancy. Then it deals with minors. What are the special laws and rules of a minor before he becomes an adult? And as you know, in Jewish law, a female becomes an adult at 12 years of age and a male becomes an adult at 13 years of age. So what are the rules for medical aspects of minors? And then it goes through, how do you treat someone on Shabbat? What do you do if someone is sick on Yom Kippur? What do you do if someone is sick on Pesach? What is he allowed to do differently because he is sick, and sometimes violating different aspects of the law because he is sick? And what are the limitations, and how do you do it best way from a Jewish perspective? So this is a huge these are huge chapters, because there are a lot of details on how to behave and act. On the one hand, to help the patient, to save his life, to reduce his suffering, and on the other hand, not to violate too much of the laws in regular circumstances. There are chapters regarding triage decisions. 10 people come injured, you have only one respirator, who do you give it to? You are in a war, and there are a lot of casualties, how do you deal with them? Who is first, who is next, and so on. The whole concept of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, what are the parameters, what is regarded as a pikuach nefesh, and once you define it a pikuach nefesh, what does it mean in practice, what can you do, what can't you do, these are types of definitions. Then there are many chapters relating to the physician. What are his obligations? How far does he have to put himself out to treat? Informed consent, confidentiality, disclosure of information, how do you do it towards your patients? How do you act towards your fellow healthcare team? How do you behave with them? How do you publish things that should be okay from a halachic point of view? Anything to do with human and animal medical experimentation, there are a lot of problems with it. Who can you experiment on? What are the limitations? What are the advantages? How do you do it from a halachic point of view? And then it comes to the end of life. How do you treat someone who is dying? Many, many issues involved nowadays. Whether you have to put him on a respirator or not. If you put him on a respirator, what do you do if he can't tolerate it? And all kinds of such questions. Definition of the moment of death. What is it? When is a person regarded halachically as dead? Organ transplants. Can you do it? Can't you do it? Which one? In what condition? And so on. And finally, how do you behave towards the dead? Can you do autopsies? How do you bury them? What parts can you do research on? And things of this nature. So it starts from before becoming a human being till after he dies. And all in between. So that's why there are so many volumes, because there are a lot of issues involved in each of the chapters that I enumerate. Any questions on that?
I have two questions, unrelated questions. My girlfriend, who lives in Israel, received, neither she nor her husband could have a child. So it's not her husband's sperm, not her egg, and she received an embryo, carried it, and has two kids. She's unrelated kids that she, and I never heard of somebody in the U.S. receiving an embryo, in vitro. But so, what is the status halakhically of those kids? And my other question, totally not related, is I know that they changed the halakha about kidney donations.
They what?
Didn't they change the halakha regarding kidney donations a number of years ago?
Kidney donation from a cadaver or from a living person? Which one are you asking? You can do both.
Living,
okay.
And I'd like...
Okay, so on the first one, if the egg and the sperm don't come from the couple, then the child is an adopted child. The fact that she carried the pregnancy, it doesn't mean anything. So the child is adopted before he was born, the same as after. There's only one position that what makes motherhood is carrying the pregnancy. And if we go by this assumption, then she may be the mother of the child, despite the fact that neither the egg nor the sperm came from her. But that's a minority opinion if it happens that way, that it doesn't involve any genetic material of this particular couple. So if we don't accept this position that the carrying, that the pregnant woman is the mother of a child, and both the sperm and the egg don't come from the couple, so it's an adopted child. Genetically, it's certainly adopted. It has nothing to do with that. So it's rarely allowed, because really it doesn't make any sense. They can adopt a child that they don't need to go through a pregnancy if it doesn't belong to them genetically at all.
So
as far as...
If the minority view is not accepted, then the child needs to be converted, is that...?
Well, if we take the mother as the mother, the pregnant woman as the mother, if she's Jewish, then there's no need of conversion. The issue of conversions come up if you take a surrogate woman, you take the egg from the couple and the sperm from the couple, but let's say the woman doesn't have a womb and she can't carry the pregnancy, so she hires another woman, that woman carries the pregnancy for the couple, and when she delivers, she gives it to the couple. But if she is not Jewish, the surrogate mother, if you go by the mother, then the child is not Jewish. Then the child will need conversion if it goes to a Jewish couple. Okay? Now, as far as a live organ donor, nothing has changed. There is no change in halacha. I mean, if someone wants to do it and the danger is minimal, then he's doing a very nice act. And actually, every one of us has two kidneys, and we can do well with one, and we can help others by donating one of our kidneys. That's fine.
But why, let's say 20 years ago, very, very few Jews were donating?
I don't know how many are donating. Today there is a move to do it, but not because anything changed in halacha. 20 years ago the halacha was the same as today, but there wasn't such a movement to tell people it's good that they should do it. Today there are groups that promote it, so you hear more about it, but it's the same concept. There's no, according to most halachic authorities, there's no obligation to donate one of our kidneys. That's why we didn't do it, I assume. I don't know if anyone here donated one of his kidneys, but most people don't do it because there's no obligation to do it. But if someone does it, he does a noble act. That's very true.
As a Jewish person, is there any difference from me donating to a non-Jew or to a Jew?
Well, it depends on what you feel. If you feel better to donate to a Jew, do it. If you feel indifferent, you're still saving your life.
Yeah, I noticed with your set, there's the two bookends are thicker.
It's not in order right now.
Oh, they're not in order. No. Okay. So what was the most complicated area of life? What would that be, towards death or towards birth? Or
all are complicated and all have solutions, so I don't know how to judge it. I mean, some have more issues, so there's more to discuss, but not necessarily because it's more difficult.
Which areas of life would you say?
The one that I think is the largest chapter here is how to treat a patient on Shabbat. Because there are so many different situations, and it has been discussed by so many authorities, that there are many, many details. But it doesn't mean that it's the most difficult or most complicated issue.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong with what you said earlier. I thought you said when someone is, let's say, suffering, let's say, toward end of life, how much of halacha do you go against or something? Because that's what it seemed like you were
against
saying, not go against, or how much of halacha do you not, I'm trying to remember the exact words, rather than what does halacha say is okay or allowed, I thought you said, how much of halacha do you not follow or do not do or something. No,
this book is you should follow halacha.
All
no matter
time.
What.
I thought you said how much of halacha should you? I thought you said something like that as you were talking.
If you talk about should, you should do 100% according to halacha. You shouldn't deviate at all. What does halacha say about certain things may be debatable. Some rabbis will say you're allowed to do it, and some will say you're not allowed. So you need to decide. How do you act? So some of the issues here are decisive. So we accept majority rather than minority opinion. You accept previous generation poskim rather than newer ones. There are rules on how to finalize the law. But once there is a law, you should follow it if you want to be an observant Jew. Can't do anything against halacha.
Yes. Have there been any discussions on the issues regarding transgender?
Yes. Transgender, for any psychological reason, which usually is the case in most instances, it's not a biological situation. Sometimes a person is born that he has two types of genders. Mm-hmm. So then you have to solve this problem one way or another. And there are halachic rules what is preferable. But usually what we talk nowadays in modern life, transgender is someone who is completely one gender and he wants to be the opposite gender for whatever psychological reasons he has, but not from a biological point of view. So that halachically is not allowed because that's a form of castration. If he is a male and he wants to become a female, he needs to be castrated. And castration is a major violation of Jewish law. You're not allowed to do it. And vice versa. The issue sometimes comes up that the person did it. Now, who is he now? Is he still the old gender, or is he the new gender? There are many, many different halachot for a male and for a female. So that is discussed at length. What will be the status if he changed? Do we go by his initial genetic makeup that stays? He didn't change his genes, right? His genes are still a male, even if he made himself a female and vice versa. Or you go by what he looks now. And there are differences of opinions how to relate to it. But there are many, many issues with it. Who can he marry? If he was a male and now he looks like a female, can he marry a male? So if he still considered a male and he marries a male, that is homosexuality. And that is not allowed. And the other way around, if he was a, if she was a female and now she looks like a male, and he, she marries a female, then it's a lesbian relationship, which is not allowed. So there are a lot of complications if it's done.
But you're saying that in the, initially when there is both gender and they have, doctors have to make a decision at birth, that it's pretty clear and it's a very small number of cases where that happens?
Right. If it happens, a decision has to be made. A normal person can't be both a man and a woman. So he has to become one or the other. So but by Jewish law, we try to make the decision right after birth. There is now an approach to leave them as they are and let them, when they become adults, to make their own decision. Obviously, the baby can't make a decision if he prefers to be changed totally to a man or totally to a woman. So the parents make the decision, or society makes the decision. And that is the preferred way from a Jewish point of view. And probably also from a psychological and educational point of view. It's very hard to keep someone with the two genders in one body, and he should go through kindergarten and school and so on. That creates a lot of problems. But there is a trend in the secular society to leave it that way for the person himself to make a decision how he wants to be finally at the end of the day. But that creates halachic problems until then. Is he a man or is he a woman? Like this, if we make a decision right after birth, that will be who he is.
So how do you make that decision right after birth?
Well, so it depends on some preferences of the parents. But halachically, it is preferable, if it's possible, to change to a male rather than to a female. Because you need to do a castration procedure in either way. Either you extract the female parts or you extract the male parts, right? And castration of a male is halachically worse than castration of a woman. So if already we have to castrate, we prefer to do it on an easier side.
But don't the hormones, if they do a blood test, can they tell if it's a male or a female?
Well, so there are true hermaphrodites that have both hormones and organs equally from a male and a female, which are quite rare. And there are pseudo-hermaphrodites, which have the body build of one then gender and the genes of the other gender. So that makes more complications because there are problems with hormones and so on. But it depends on each case what it is.
Could you have a case, we had a case where someone was born with both, with signs for both male and female, they chose male. When the child grew up, he expressed feeling that he was a female. And there was a feeling that some people had that maybe they made a mistake, and he had gender dysphoria, but he was, you know, diagnosed with gender dysphoria, and they felt that he was suicidal, and that if he would be able to transition to becoming a female, he would no longer be suicidal, and then would be comfortable. But can't know for sure, but and this is a male, so it would be.
Yeah, but if it is suicidal, then it's already a pikuach nefesh,
yeah.
And pikuach nefesh certainly, it's not one of the three sins that you are not allowed to violate even for pikuach nefesh. So if the assessment is that it's a pikuach nefesh,
right,
I think it would be allowed to rechange the situation.
Right.
My question is regarding a hospital on Shabbat. Now, if the patient needs a nurse, I know there's a concept of a grama, but how would that work if somebody's really sick and they need the nurse right then, not in 12 seconds or something? So when they press the button, can they press the button on Shabbat to call for the nurse?
Well, there are buttons that are designed in a way that halachically it's okay, which means that when you press the button, you don't cause an electric circuit. It is just something mechanical, so that there is a window that covers the light. The light is on all the time, and there's a window that covers it. And when you press, it just lifts the lid, and then you see that he is calling someone. So that is perfectly fine, and in Shalat Tzedek, that is how it's run. So there are technical things that can help solve halachic issues. But if, in this hospital, I assume they don't...
Not yet.
Hopefully they will come. So if it is something urgent, a pikuach nefesh, then he is allowed to do it. Better to do it what we call bishinu. Did you discuss it?
I mean, that's what I tell patients, but you could explain.
Right, to do it in an unusual manner. If you press the regular way, that is forbidden. But if you press it in a way that no one does it, then it's less of a prohibition. And therefore, if you know how to deal halachically with your needs on Shabbat, and that's a great part of what's written here. How do you do many such acts that are better if you do it in a different way, or even better if you do it in a mechanical way that is altogether okay? So these are various... So this is one of the examples.
So now I'm just going to interrupt, because now we're at the halfway point, and I didn't tell you what the second part of today's talk. Then we'll have more time for question and answer. And I can tell you, everything that's come up so far is dealt with in his new book. Now we're going to go to part two of this discussion. And then again, like I said, we'll have time for a question and answer open up at the end. Dr. Steinberg, the accolades are endless. So that's why I told you just a couple of them and introduced him. But there's a lot of things that he does. One of them is that he's on the Pope's Ethics Committee. So many of you know, it's like sometimes you joke, people ask me, oh, you're a rabbi, what should we call you? Rabbi, Rabbi Jason, Rabbi Weiner. So as you know, my answer always is, Your Excellency, that's what you should call me. But it's a joke. Obviously, I'm joking. But Dr. Steinberg, and I think he's the first Jewish or the only Jew?
In part, it's not the...
Okay, so we'll hear about it. So it's just a fascinating thing. He's on the Pope's Ethics Committee. We thought we'd ask him to share a little bit about what that's been like, and then we'll have more time for questions.
So I have two jobs, so to speak, with the Vatican. One is that I think the previous pope, or maybe one before him, established the Academy for Life Science. And it's a religious Catholic academy dealing with end of life from the perspective of the Catholics. And all officers there are Catholic clergy, archbishops, cardinals, bishops, and so on. And they invited me a few years ago to give a lecture on how Jewish law views issues of end of life. And it turned out that in principle, we are very close. We have the same principles, which are very different than the secular approach to end of life. So we can join forces and try to show the world that there's another way to deal with end of life issues from a faith point of view, which is mutual to the Christians and the Jews. By the way, the Islam has a very similar approach as well. So we actually, the monotheistic religions, are opposed to the secular way of dealing with end of life. So I gave my lecture and I went home. After a while, I get a letter from an appointment by the Pope, Francis, that I am appointed as a member in the Papal Academy of Life Sciences. And it was the first time that not only a rabbi became a member there, but someone who is not Catholic at all. Even that they didn't have. So by now they opened a little bit the membership of this academy. And I am now proud to say that I am an appointment by the Pope as a member of a papal, I think a very important academy that tries to show a different way for the whole world on how to deal with end-of-life issues. So every half a year we have a meeting, the members come together in the Vatican and we discuss all kinds of issues related to end-of-life. So that is one aspect that I am involved with the Catholic Church. The other one, maybe I should give a little bit background on what happened after World War II in the relationship between Christianity, or at least the Catholic viewpoint, and the Jews. For generations, as we all know, the theology, the Christian theology, was that the Jews were the chosen people, and once Christianity came, they replaced the Jews, and they are now the chosen people. That was the theology of Christianity. And according to their theology initially, the Jews are to disappear. They are not needed anymore, because now there's a new chosen group by God, and the Jews will disappear, and the Christian will become the sons or the representatives of God in the world. However, it didn't happen. Jews didn't disappear. Jews continued to exist, although they were in exile and they were persecuted and they had a hard life, they were poor. So there was a little bit of a change in the Christian thinking that the Jews indeed are no more the chosen people, and they are left in the world to show that sinners are punished for what they are. That was one way to look at what Jews are doing nowadays in the world. But what made a major impact on some of the Christian theology was the establishment of the State of Israel. We are no more persecuted, we are no more in exile, we are back to our homeland, and we are a regular nation. That goes contrary to the fact that we were chosen people and were supposed to disappear. So I think Pope John 23rd made a change in the understanding of the theology of Christianity, and instead of reading the Jews were the chosen people, he made it the Jews are the chosen people, and we, the Christians, are the next chosen people. So we are actually both still chosen people. That is how the theology goes nowadays. They also changed the approach to the question whether the Jews were responsible for crucifying Jesus. So it used to be that all Jews are responsible for all generations because they did something so terrible. Now the understanding is that there were a few Jews at the time that either participated or perhaps even were responsible for crucifying Jesus, but it's only they that should be punished and not all the rest of the Jews at that time that weren't part of it, and certainly not the following generations who had nothing to do with what happened then, and therefore we are exempt from the sin of being responsible for crucifying Jesus. That's, I think, a very major change in the theology. So Pope John 23rd, followed by the next Pope, I forgot who it was, composed something which is really a change in the attitude between Christianity and Judaism, and it's called Nostra Aetate. Nostra Aetate means in our days, or in our time, or in our era. And it's a document, quite short, that includes 5 paragraphs, and it deals with the relationship of Christianity to other religions. So there's a paragraph, how does Christianity relate to Islam? How do they relate to Eastern religions, Hindu and Confucius and all kinds of those? And paragraph number 4 is the relationship to Jews. And in this paragraph, it says what I said now, that from now on, the Jews are regarded still as the chosen people. They are not to be accused for what happened 2,000 years ago as a community that everyone is accused of it, certainly not current generations, and that they go against anti-Semitism that is wrong from a theological point of view, and they beg pardon for the years of execution and persecution that they did to the Jews. So the Nostra Aetate really is a major, major change in the relationship between at least the Catholics, maybe all of Christianity, and the Jews. Following the Nostra Aetate, I think it was finalized in 1965, there was an agreement between the Pope and the chief rabbis of Israel to establish an inter-religion dialogue committee with representatives from the Vatican and representatives from the chief rabbinate, meeting together annually and discussing issues that are of mutual interest. And since about 8 years ago, I am a member of this inter-religion dialogue from the chief rabbinate of Israel's side. And as I said, we meet annually, once in the Vatican and once in Jerusalem. The Vatican Commission is led by Cardinal Turkson, who used to be the Archbishop of Ghana. I think he's the only black cardinal that reached such a degree. And in my understanding, he is what they call Papabile, which means that he's one of the cardinals that can be chosen to be a pope. There are only 20 or 30 such people all over the world. He's a very, very nice and open person. It's a pleasure to work with him. And there are some other archbishops and members of the Catholic delegation. And there are some rabbis from the chief rabbinate side. And as I say, I am one of this delegation. And we meet actually every year together for 3 days. And we choose usually a topic that is not deep theology, because there's no chance that we'll agree on deep theology issues. But we choose issues that we can agree on, and usually we do agree on. So it's using religion for violence, for instance, coming out against the extreme Islam that we both feel is wrong, dealing with the poor in the world, how to distribute the economy in a more righteous way so that there won't be so many poor people, and it's feasible. I mean, United States throws away so much produce just to keep the prices a little up, where with this produce you can save millions of hungry people in Africa or in India and so on. So there are a lot of things that can and should be done, and we agree on it. I mean, there's no controversy between our approach and theirs. But everyone brings sources that comes from their own religion. So we come up at the end with the same conclusion, but from different angles and discussions. So that is the other part that I am involved with the Catholic religion. I think it's important. It shows that what used to be a terrible situation with persecution, with anti-Semitism that came from the Christian world. Now, unfortunately, we both suffer from the extreme Islamists. The Christian in Syria or in Iraq suffer as we Jews used to suffer in Christian countries. And now it turned that the Christians are suffering from the extreme Islamic. We obviously too, but the Christians as well. So the world has changed, and hopefully we'll be able to do something similar with Islam. And then Mashiach will come, and peace will come in the world, and everyone will be happy, rather than what we see today.
Questions?
What's a halakhic view on abortion overall, every stage, etc.? Just like to know. Is that too harsh?
I don't know how much time we have. So I'll say it briefly. Abortion by Jewish law, as opposed here, for instance, we differ from the Catholics. We have a different approach, not diametrically opposing, but different. In Jewish law, in principle, abortion is not permissible because it's a potential human being, and sometimes it's already a human being, depends on the stage of the pregnancy, and it's a matter of destroying a life or a potential life. However, there are exceptions to the rule in Jewish law, and there are occasions where abortion is permissible. So the first one that's accepted by everyone is when pregnancy or the expected delivery might endanger the life of the mother. So here the rule is that if the fetus is pursuing the mother and trying to kill her, obviously he doesn't want to do it, but that's the situation, then her life takes precedence over his life because she is already a full human being. And he is only a potential human being, so the levels are different. And when the fetus endangers the life of the mother, abortion is permissible. That was, for many generations, the rule. We have even in the Mishnah already discussion about it, in the Talmud. Nowadays, it's very, very rare such occasion, because almost all the time, we can do something that will save both. There's no need today to kill the fetus to save the mother because we have today means to save both. So that became a rare situation where abortion should be performed, although it's permissible. But it wouldn't come to that degree because we can treat it. We know how to do a C-section, we can take out the fetus even if the delivery is complicated and therefore there will be no danger to the mother. We know how to treat illnesses of the mother in pregnancy so that the pregnancy will not make her worse and so on. So that became a rarity. The issue that is discussed in abortion is relatively new, and that is when the fetus is unhealthy in various degrees. Are we allowed to abort him in order to save him from living in a bad way? That is totally new. Why? Because in the old days, there was no way to know what the situation of the fetus is. Nowadays, that we know, either by ultrasound or by amniocentesis or by other means of identification, we can tell what the health of this fetus is and will be. Now, if it will turn out to be a significant disability of the fetus, are we allowed to perform an abortion not to save the mother? The mother is healthy. She can go on with the pregnancy and deliver and give it back. But the fetus will be born as a sick child. And here, it depends what level of sickness we are talking about and how does the mother take the situation? These are the two conditions that are discussed. So if the disease that the fetus has is regarded as lethal, either he'll die in utero or he'll die shortly after he'll be born, then almost all the rabbis agree that you're allowed to abort because anyway they'll die. So why continue with the pregnancy and have the mother all this anxiety when anyway the fetus will die? But if the disability expected is such that he will live but have a disability, that according to most rabbis is not a reason to kill him. Why? Because let's say he is born and we see the disability and we know that he'll suffer terribly. Are we allowed to kill him after he's born? So there were times that the answer was yes. The Greek, the Romans killed disabled children. So a child that was born blind, they killed him. Now that we know that he will be blind, but he still wasn't born, we say it's okay to kill him. Why is it better than before he was born than after he was born? So the reason for it usually is a psychological one. If I see him alive, I can't kill him. But if he is covered by the tummy of the mother, then I don't have any hesitation and I want to kill him. That is very problematic. Why should we do it? Then there is the question of the staging. When in pregnancy do we find out that he'll be very sick? So halachically, there is a distinction between the first 40 days and the subsequent days of pregnancy. So if it's possible to diagnose a serious disease within 40 days of pregnancy, there are some who would say he's still not a human being at all by halachic criteria up to 40 days, and therefore you can abort him. But after that, he's already a potential human being, and then even if he has a disease, expected to have a disease, we cannot terminate the pregnancy. In secular world, the distinction is a little different, and it is between pre-viability and after-viability. Usually the marking line is 22, 23, 24 weeks of gestation, depends on the different countries and the statistics. So if a fetus is diagnosed as having a severe disease prior to 22 weeks of gestation, then legally, many countries would allow to perform an abortion. If he's already in a viable stage, more than 23, 24 weeks of gestation, then many countries, including this country, will not allow to abort such a fetus, even if he's expected to be sick. Interestingly, in Israel, the law, which is a secular law, Israel is a secular country, the law doesn't distinguish between pre-viability and post-viability. And if there is a severe disability, you can perform an abortion even 30, 34, 35 weeks of gestation, which usually is done by first killing the fetus in utero by injecting him a lethal dose that kills him, and then they perform the abortion, which halachically is certainly wrong, and whoever wants to do it halachically right wouldn't agree to do it. Okay?
Pretty sure to ask question.
So, is this question either in terms of if there's any halachic discussion or on the Pope's commission there's been any discussion of uterine transplant? I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. That's part of why I'm asking if you are.
It's not. These issues, we don't go to such resolutions in the discussions with the committees. We did deal with end-of-life issues, not only in the academy, but also in the committee. But such resolution we don't go into. But a uterine transplant is probably like an incubator. Because it doesn't belong to the mother, right? It comes from a different woman. But it doesn't contribute anything to the fetus as such. It's not an egg or a sperm that the genetic material creates the fetus. It is just an incubator. So that would be like a surrogate mother, like any other surrogate mother. Yes.
I wanted to know if in Israel, well, now that you're saying it goes by secular law, in terms of being able to give organs after you die.
Yeah. If so everyone agrees, everyone halachically and not halachically agrees that if the person is dead and he has viable organs, and with these organs he can save a life, everyone agrees that he should do it.
Like check on your driver's license. Like halakhically,
yeah.
Don't you have to do something special?
No. So let's go step by step. First of all, if the person is dead and he has a viable organ that can save a life of someone who needs it, all agree halakhically, ethically, legally, all over the world that it's the right thing to do. Where's the problem? Halachically, the problem is, how do you define the person dead? What is the definition of death? Now, if you go by the old school of definition, which is both respiration and heart that stop, then you have no organs to transplant, because once the heart stops, the organs die, and you have nothing to give. But if you accept what we call the brain death criteria, and you say halachically he's dead by brain death criteria, at this stage, if he's on a respirator, the heart is still functioning, and therefore all the other organs are functioning. And if you call him dead, you can take all these organs and save other life. So the question is not whether or not you're allowed to give organs after death. You're certainly allowed and even obligated. The question is, when can you do it? Because it depends on how you define the moment of death. That's the only problem from a halachic point of view. All the rest, desecration of the body, not burying parts of it, all these are violations of halachic rulings, but they are put aside because of pikuach nefesh, because you're saving life. So if you would take out an organ, even after cardiac death, in order to play with it, or to sell it, or to do some kind of research, then it won't be allowed, because then you desecrate the body, you're not burying the spout, that is a violation. But if you do the same process, but the intention is to save life, we violate a lot of things in order to save life. We work on Shabbat when usually we're not allowed. We eat on Yom Kippur in order not to die, right? So we violate a lot of laws in order to save life. So that part is taken care of. The only question is he really dead? Because killing is not one of the issues that you're allowed to violate even in order to save life. I can't kill you in order to take your heart and save someone else. I'm still saving someone. But I'm doing it by killing you, that I can't do.
And if it's for skin grafting or cornea, that's just quality of life, not saving life.
Right. So that is a more complex question. A cornea, someone who is blind, is not going to die, even if he stays blind. So you're just giving him a better quality of life. Are you allowed even then to take an organ like the cornea and cause better quality of life? Skin usually is given to a third degree, 90% to burn, that's saving life, and therefore skin usually is not an issue, unless you take it only for plastic surgery and you just want to make the nose a little nicer, then will be a problem. But if you do it for a potential life saving, that would be okay.
So the answer is no. We can't put in the back of our ID or license driver that we are organ donor.
No, depends on your
condition. And don't know. I mean, if something happens and
they're not going to change your treatment. They're not going to change your treatment. So if you're technically
we're just saying okay for organ.
You have to decide before you sign or you mark it if you accept brain death or not.
Right.
If you accept brain death, you should sign it. If you don't accept brain death.
Even in America, they should put on their driver's license?
Well, There is a problem.
Yeah, let him answer. Let him answer.
Yeah, there is a problem. And next, first of all, in principle, let's talk about principle. In principle, if you agree, you or you ask your rabbi or you searched yourself and you came to the conclusion, which are many rabbis who agree, that brainless is okay, Allah. Then, theoretically, you can be an organ donor because taking out your organ after brainless is taking out an organ from a dead person. So that is the theory. In practice, there is a problem on how you diagnose brainless. Beyond the question whether or not brainless is the moment of death. So let's assume it is. It is not so simple to diagnose it, practically speaking, medically speaking. So we in Israel have a way to do it, which so far other countries did not accept. And those rabbis who agree that brain death in principle is the moment of death would require a procedure how to diagnose brain death, which is different here than what is required. So if you want to be an organ donor after brain death, because you accepted brain death, you have to make sure that they'll do here the same way as they do there, and they're willing to do it. You just have to know to request
it. To keep it in your wallet.
But also, how do we know what organ are they use? Quality of life
versus... Oh, so we didn't finish answering that question. So what about the quality of life? Is that...
Right. So you should really mark all the... If you have an option, which organs... So first of all, you should mark those that are life-saving. Okay? Now, organs that are not life-saving depends which organs and who do you follow. So, as I said, skin, in many instances, is a life-saving procedure, but not in all. So you have to specify, you are willing that they will take the skin only for life-saving procedures, such as burn, not for cosmetic surgery. Cornea, there are some who agree that you're allowed to take even the cornea, for reasons that I don't have time to go halachically, but there is a way to allow it. And others who say no. So you have to ask whoever you count on whether you should agree to cornea or not. Other things like bone, and there are all kinds of parts of arm and so on that are done for cosmetic purposes that you can't agree. I think
we're out of time now, but we're not rushing out. So if people want to come and ask Dr. Steinberg a question, Bavakasha.